Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's been another oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico, this one about 80 miles south of Vermilion Bay, Louisiana, which is west of New Orleans and west of the site of that deadly BP Deepwater Horizon rig explosion back in April. 13 workers were reportedly on the rig that exploded today. No deaths have been reported. And the Coast Guard is reporting that a mile-long oil machine has been spotted. Let's catch up with Zach Prudhomme, a senior producer at KLFY TV 10 in Lafayette, Louisiana. Zach, to the most important thing, the workers first. Earlier today, we heard that they were all spotted in the water wearing those so-called Gumby suits that would protect them. But you also told us earlier today that you have colleagues there at work who, at least one who knew someone on the rig and wasn't getting any information about workers. So what do we know now about those 13 workers?
Well, unfortunately, with the person who has personal ties to the station, they still have not heard anything about the person that they know out there.
Huh. But we have been hearing reports that those 13 workers were plucked from the water.
Yes, they were taken from the water there, and what we heard was that they're all being taken to the hospital in Terrebonne Parish, and that one of them is suffering with minor injuries.
Okay. Well, what do we know about the rig itself? We're hearing all these conflicting reports. The BBC reporting that this rig was not producing gas or oil at the time of the explosion, but that the owner of the rig had seven wells nearby. But then the AP reporting that the platform is a fixed petroleum platform that was in production at the time of today's fire.
Actually, I have some good stuff on that. We just had a press conference with our governor a few minutes ago, and he mentioned a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. He said that there are actually two pipelines that are coming onto shore from the platform. One's active, one's not. So that may be the source of confusion right there.
Well, and what does that mean, though? I mean, connect the dots to this oil sheen.
I mean, I'm not an oil field expert, but from what I understand, you know, one of them is just kind of there, and the other one is actually being used. And then what they're saying, too, kind of along those lines, is the fire, like what's burning, they think it's something called, condensate. It's something in storage called condensate, which, from what I understand, is a liquid form of natural gas.
Okay, well, this could be the methane issue, perhaps, that we saw in the BP rig. By the way, who owns this rig?
The name of the company is,
I have it right here. It's Mariner Energy. They're based in Houston.
Mariner Energy.
Yep. But we understand, in fact, that a bigger company, Apache, was expected to buy Mariner Energy out in order to pursue deep water drilling. But, you know, deep water drilling is so controversial. Was this rig in deep water?
No. From what we were hearing, it's shallow water.
Okay. How much? Do you know?
Not off the top of my head.
That's okay.
I know there's been a lot of back and forth about it, but actually I have it right here. I have that the rig was in 350 feet of water.
Okay, so a response might be easier. Still in all, and by the way, Zach Prudhomme, again from KLFY TV 10 in Lafayette, Louisiana, a name that might be familiar to many. You're a relative of Paul Prudhomme, the famous chef in the area, so you are of that area. How are people there reacting to this? Another explosion?
Yeah, people are pretty afraid, pretty scared. We've had calls already from people all day. You know, hey, my friend's on there, my loved one on there, we're not hearing anything. You know, people hear offshore explosion, and the first thing they think of is the Deepwater Horizon and that fiery image that we've all seen. So anything like that just brings back all of those memories and all of those fears. And what we're trying to do is find out as much as we can, which I know you are too, to try and ease those concerns if there's no reason for any right now.
Well, meantime, we just have a few seconds left here, but we understand Coast Guard helicopters, airplanes, cutters are headed to the scene. Are there any pictures yet from the scene?
We actually have one picture that we got from someone who remains anonymous, didn't want to share his name, but he was 2 miles away when it happened. And just kind of to describe the picture, it's just a little dot in the distance, but you can definitely see a very strong, thick line of smoke coming from it.
Okay. That's Zach Prudhomme, senior producer at KLFY TV 10 in Lafayette, Louisiana, on the oil rig that exploded today in the Gulf of Mexico. Zach, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the surprises at this week's Emmy Awards was the HBO film Temple Grandin winning 7 Emmys, including Best TV Movie, with the extraordinary woman who inspired the film jumping up from the audience to accept applause. What a minor miracle. Temple Grandin was diagnosed as autistic as a child in the 50s. She had no social skills, but her mother refused to institutionalize her. She began to speak at the age of 4, then went to college and grad school, received a master's in animal science, and is now a professor at Colorado State University, the author of a number of books, including her latest, Animals Make Us Human. She's also the force behind a move to treat animals raised for food with compassion. Temple's autism enabled her to see patterns in cow herds and ultimately design equipment and techniques for feedlots and slaughterhouses to improve the animals' lives. In this scene from the HBO movie, actress Claire Danes portrays Temple trying to convince the industry that what she saw as more compassionate treatment for animals was also better for business.
Spooked cattle don't act straight. They get bruised, scraped, drowned. That all costs money. It takes a good half hour to calm a herd, and that costs money, too. It's not a good way to run a stockyard. Well, I believe what's good for cattle is also good for business.
Temple was triumphant in some corners. Many in the industry stopped beating animals with cattle prods or used her equipment to take advantage of animals' natural tendencies to move them calmly along chutes, even to their deaths. And that's why her critics say that means Temple enables the industry. We asked her about that in our conversation earlier this year, but we started with how she thought the industry had changed.
Things are much better now than they were in the 70s. So there's a lot of other people out there now working on low-stress cattle handling. But when I first started back in the 70s and I found out that the cattle were scared of things like reflections, chains hanging down, you know, shiny pieces of metal, people thought it was just crazy. And I found that if I remove those kind of things from the facility, cattle would go right through the facility. Another thing I've learned since the 70s is in the 70s, during the movie, I thought I could fix everything with equipment. What I have found now is I can only fix half of it with equipment. You've got to supervise things and have good management.
Well, in fact, you write about even now auditing plants. You tell them that they can save up to $1,000 a day by treating animals better, and they don't.
People have a way of slipping back into old habits. I go to an equipment startup and get everything going wonderful. I've got the electric prods put away. I got the yelling and screaming stopped. They're moving small groups of animals, and then they gradually drift back into old methods. And the way to stop this is numerical scoring. I developed a very simple scoring system for scoring handling. And then I can tell, is it getting better? Is it getting worse? How many animals fall down? How many cattle are mooing and bellowing as they come up the chute? How many cattle I get poked with the electric prodder? These are things that I can count, and I can tell, is the handling getting better or is the handling getting worse? Because people can drift back into old bad methods and not even realize they're doing it.
And
I call that bad becoming normal.
Bad becoming normal. They just accept it. But why does that happen?
There's about 20% of people that can just stay really good stock people. They're naturally good stock people. Then there's a big, huge middle ground of people where you have to keep managing and measuring it. And then, unfortunately, there's a few people that just should not be handling animals, and they have to be fired. And I know that's sounding really hard-nosed, but there's some things I've learned in 35 years, and that's something I've learned.
Well, and you say when you look at researchers, managers, some people may not be aware because all this information isn't out there. Some people just don't want to see animals as individuals, as things other than just machines that produce food. There are some researchers who just can't look at them that way.
Well, I've had problems with that. We did a paper a long time ago showing that you could get very low-stress handling of Bongo and Nyala antelopes at the zoo by training them to cooperate with the veterinary procedures. And I sent a paper into a vet journal, and it got rejected because some reviewer thought it was judgmental. He didn't want to admit that the rough ways that they collected blood and captured the animals out in the wild, they were stressing the living you-know-what out of them. They didn't want to admit that. Some people don't want to use the fear word. Even though research is very clear that animals do have emotions, they do feel fear. But most of that research has been over in the neuroscience literature. It's only been recently it started to drift over into some of the veterinarian and some of the other behavior literature.
So you're saying that it's hard for people to look at these animals as something that might have emotion, that might have feeling, because then they might have to question the way they're treating them.
Well, I feel very strongly that we've got to be treating animals right, and cattle raised right have a good life. One of the things that kept me in the industry, even though a lot of bad stuff was happening back in the 70s, there were a few ranchers that were really good. I remember Bill and Penny Porter, Singing Valley Ranch, just absolutely beautiful. They treated their cattle really well. There were some of the feed yard people that were good. There were people at the plant that were good, and I could see that beef had been, you know, could really be done right. If I had started out in some horrible chicken place, I think maybe my career might have taken a different path than the one I have now.
Well, you know, Temple, I want to ask you about that because, coincidentally, we just had animal activist Melanie Joy on the program. Her book is Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, Wear Cows. Her premise is you can never have a humane way to eat animals. She says, would you eat a humanely raised golden retriever? But, Temple, here's where you and author Michael Pollan split with other animal rights activists. You think that there are always going to be food animals, so let's improve their lot. Why?
Well, I think, for one thing, I think grazing animals definitely have a place, in the ecosystem. Animals put phosphorus back on the soil. I mean, I think food animals are part of the natural cycle, but we've got to treat them really, really well. And pigs and chickens have got some of the biggest problems. And I was just horrified at some of the stuff going on with egg layers. I think people had forgotten their chickens.
Well, just briefly, let's touch on chickens and pigs.
Well, you just can't have people in there taking gate rods and beating pigs up with that. And on the other hand, managers have to make sure they don't understaff and overwork. I've worked on cattle vaccinating crew for 10 or 11 hours in 100-degree heat in Arizona, and you just get so tired that you just about can't stand it. But it gets down to management. If there's an employee in a place taking a gate rod, beating up a pig with it, that's the manager's problem, and the manager probably needs to get fired.
Other things you found in an audit for the American Meat Institute, 5 automatic fails.
Yeah, I have 5 things I measure, automatic failures. Beating up animals, dragging animals, slamming gates on purpose, dragging animals over the top of other animals, and sticking things into sensitive areas. That's automatic fail. They have to all be dead before they cut them up. Only 1% of the animals can fall. And if they have more than 3 cattle out of 100 mooing as they go into the stun box, they're going to fail the audit. That's really made a difference.
You say reward workers for their treatment of animals, for reductions in bruise injuries. You talk about one company that rewards workers every month for the truck drivers with the fewest dead pigs, and that does motivate them to handle them better.
That you can use economic motivators.
You say, though, you also have to be aware of management, because it's not just the worker. They're under the whip sometime of the management, which is why they might push a downer cow that can't walk to slaughter.
Well, that's absolutely right. And the movie shows a very early career in the 70s, like a fix-it-all with equipment. Then I started training employees. Then I got to training managers. Now I'm spending most of my time working with customers. The thing that I found that made the most change was getting major customers, such as McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, major food service companies, to audit the meat plants for animal welfare using the scoring system. And I found that in most of the plants, I could fix them with a lot of simple fixes, lots of non-slip floors put in stunning boxes. You know, cows and pigs don't like to go into the dark, so you put a light on the entrance of a chute. You move a light to get rid of a reflection. You put a shield up so they don't see the people walking by, and you train the staff on how to handle animals, and you have to keep measuring. It's just like speed limits. If you don't keep measuring it, people will be going 100 miles an hour down the freeway.
Our conversation with animal scientist Temple Grandin from earlier this year. Interesting, she spoke of being horrified at what happened to egg layers, chickens, and factory farms. We were reminded of that in the recent news about eggs. We'll hear more from Temple. Also later today, a treasure trove of jazz, newly discovered old recordings. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with animal scientist Professor Temple Grandin, whose story was told in the HBO TV movie that picked up 7 Emmys this week. At the award ceremony, Temple took to the stage and gave the film's producer, Emily Gerson-Sains, a huge hug, which was fascinating to see because, as we learned in the movie, as a child, Temple couldn't bear to be hugged. It's a common trait in autism. But as Temple developed her love for farm animals, devising equipment and techniques to help them be less frightened on feedlots and in slaughterhouses, she noticed ranch hands putting cows in steel contraptions that gently squeezed them and immediately calmed them down. So she built one for herself, sort of a doghouse with sides that she could pull in. It calmed her as well. Here's a scene from the film in which Temple is in her squeeze box in her college dorm room. Her blind roommate notices a change in her voice.
You're quieter now. Is that because you're in your squeeze machine?
Well, I was just getting out. Is my voice that different?
It is to me. Remember, I see you through your voice.
We're the same. Only you have sounds and I have pictures.
A scene from the Emmy-winning film Temple Grandin. Well, Temple no longer uses the squeeze machine. As we said, she's able to hug people now, but she still sees in pictures. In the film, for instance, someone mentions shoes, and suddenly we see what Temple sees, images of shoes she once wore or pictures of shoes from catalogs. And she gave us another example.
Like the word horse was said, and you see all these different individual horses, one on a calendar, you know, another horse out on Route 119.
Is that really how you see things when you hear the word horse?
Yes.
You see all sorts of images?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, and the way that's shown in the movie is absolutely accurate. See, I'm a visual thinker. My mind works like Google for images. I don't think in words.
It's amazing.
That's how I think.
Well,
if I don't have pictures, I don't have thought.
Like, what are you seeing right now when you're talking to me? I suppose maybe I need to give you a subject.
Well, I'm inside a kind of a weird little sound booth that has all this foam rubber with little pyramids sticking out. So now I'm seeing this big chamber that NASA tests rockets in, because this booth kind of reminds me of that. So now I'm seeing the picture of Dr. Carlock with the rocket taking off in the movie.
That was your high school science teacher who shut off
That's
a rocket.
Right.
Yeah.
Now I'm seeing the little booth the parking lot attendant sits in at the Denver airport.
So being in a booth makes you see a parking lot attendant in Denver.
That's right.
In a booth. Wow.
Yeah, this is just a single person booth.
How has, because we know in addition to the fame that you received for your work with animals, you've also been working with autism. You've become a subject. What are you trying to help people discover?
Well, I want to just give people practical information on how to handle animals. How can we make real, practical, good change? You know, when a mother comes up to me and says, well, your book enabled my child to go to college, that makes me really, really happy. Or a rancher says, you know, a piece of equipment really worked. Or I go out to the plants and I'm seeing that the auditing system has really improved the handling. Recently, I went to one of the plants in Nebraska, and the handling was so beautiful, totally quiet. That makes me happy.
And again, for people who say, and if they read your books, see the films, your love for animals, your identification with animals is just intent.
I think more like how an animal thinks. I don't think in language. You want to understand animals, you got to get away from verbal language.
And animals, you feel, are very visual.
Well, they have to be. The only way the animal brain can store information, since they don't have verbal language, is picture files, audio files, little smell whiff files, touch sensations. There's no other way they can store the information.
So, again, here you identify so closely with animals. So, you know, how is it that you can stand there? Yes, you designed a better platform. It has grooves so they don't slip. They're not frightened. But they walk right up to their death, a stun gun right between,
well,
you know,
everything,
by the eyes.
Everything dies eventually. One of the things that working on slaughterhouses has done for me is it's made me look right at my own mortality. And when it gets to be my time, I hope I can say that I've done something to actually make the world a better place.
And do you really think, as you've said, these animals, they wouldn't exist if they weren't bred for food for humans. But do you really think that's a better life than not existing at all?
Well, there are some animals where their life is not good. I actually heard, I think it was Mrs. Nyman from Nyman Ranch that said, you have to give them a life worth living. I really liked the way that was put. And after I had designed my center track restrainer system, went out on this big catwalk over all these big, huge stockyards, all these cattle in here, and I looked down at them and I thought, well, if we didn't breed these cattle, they wouldn't be here at all. But we've got to give them a life worth living.
Well, so those are Temple Grandin's opinions on food animals. But Temple, you also write about pets, and so while we have you, just some quick thoughts of yours there. You say, for instance, black cats are the friendliest cats. I would concur. But red cats are what?
Red cats tend to be, the marmalade cats tend to be very, very, very affectionate, but real skittish. You make a rapid movement, they'll jump away.
Dogs, you say, one of the biggest areas of abuse that we just don't even notice are the amount of dogs that are left at home alone.
You know, people are worried about, you know, about pigs and chickens. I mean, there are some dogs that are just home alone all day. They're chewing up their paw. They're chewing up the house. Those are not happy dogs. And dogs are hypersocial, and it takes a lot of work to give a dog a good life.
And horses. You say that horses can be fearful of one very specific thing, and then it's always that specific thing. Let's say a white shirt. So how do you change that?
Well, the reason the horse might get afraid of a white shirt is if somebody whipped that horse, and right when the horse was getting whipped, he was looking at a white shirt. I knew a horse that was scared to death of overhead garage doors, because when he fell on his butt, he was looking at an overhead garage door.
So he took the photograph in his mind.
That's right. He took a photograph in his mind of the thing he was looking at right when the bad stuff happened. Sometimes when dogs get hit by cars, they see the Jones's front door. So now they're afraid of the Jones's front door instead of being afraid of the car.
Temple Grandin, a professor at Colorado State University, also the author with Katherine Johnson of Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. For more on the book and the Emmy-winning HBO film about Temple, go to hereandnow.org. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, funding libraries in a bad economy. What choices should libraries make when computers are popular and books arguably less so? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, bed bugs. The hotel industry downplays the problem, but did you know there's a new online bed bug registry, a database of unverified bed bug sightings? And experts say the rise in bed bugs is due to the decline in the use of pesticides and the increase of travel. We'll have more.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Earl is hurling towards the eastern seaboard with winds of up to 140 miles per hour, leaving people scrambling to change vacation and wedding plans from North Carolina to up here in Massachusetts. The head of the National Hurricane Center says the storm is changing. Its winds will extend farther out from the eye of the storm, but no word on how far inland the storm will hit. AAA says about 35 million people nationwide will be traveling this holiday weekend, but Earl and Tropical Storm Fiona, which is now south of Bermuda, might change that. Kevin Overstreet of Virginia is one of tens of thousands of people who left North Carolina's Outer Banks after a mandatory evacuation order.
I think we need to get the heck out of here, personally. I've got an ocean on one side and a sound on the other. It's not my cup of tea.
Aaron James of the Virginian Pilot is in Avon, North Carolina, at the southern tip of the Outer Banks. Aaron, how do things look to you?
Well, the weather here is actually still pretty calm. I'm looking at the ocean right now at Cape Point, and it's definitely picking up. The water's coming in pretty rough. Wind has picked up since this morning, but otherwise it's still a pretty nice day.
But we mentioned that there were mandatory evacuations. What does that mean?
It means that the county really wants people to leave. They strongly recommend that you leave, but they will not force you to. The word mandatory is a little bit of a misnomer in that there's nobody knocking on doors saying, hey, you got to go now. In fact, like I said, I'm looking at the beach, and there's a half dozen people just in my sights right now, enjoying the beach, looking at the ocean, and getting ready for a lot of changes in the next few hours. I understand from talking to locals the last few hours, a lot of people are staying.
What about tourists?
I think tourists have left for the most part. I talked to some yesterday who really didn't have a choice because when they were contacted by the property owners of the properties that they were renting, they were told to leave immediately. They really didn't have a choice, and without having their own property to stay in, they had to go. Whereas with the locals, they can stay if they so choose. It's definitely a lot calmer around here. It doesn't look like tourist season, and yet there are people on the streets, there are cars, and right now there's people on the beach.
Well, then why do they choose to stay?
A lot of people just say it's because it's what people on Hatteras Island do. It's the Outer Banks way. What they say is they prepare for the worst and hope for the best. I've seen people boarding up windows today, doing last-minute stocking up on supplies at a local hardware store, getting groceries, things like that. there is concern. I think people are expecting the storm to stay offshore and to be not too devastating, but there is concern that if that storm makes a last-minute cut, that it could cause quite a bit of destruction.
Well, of course, it's a hurricane. We don't know the path that it's going to take.
Sure.
We're hearing here in the Boston area that if it changes just slightly, we could have perhaps something on Friday, but nothing Saturday or Sunday. What else are you hearing about the path as it travels up the coast?
The consensus, from what I'm hearing for people at the pilot as well as the locals, people really feel confident that the storm is going to stay off the coast, that the strongest part of it is not going to come ashore. We know that we are going to get hurricane force winds, meaning over 100 miles an hour, probably going to reach the coast. We know that there's going to be a significant storm surge of that storm pushing water onto the beaches and into the towns. But I think people are being optimistic right now.
Well, here in Boston, we're seeing pictures of police officers in full uniform out in the water with swimmers. They're restricting areas mm-hmm. where people can swim because of the riptides, so closing uh-huh. off stretches of beaches. But, these storms are always like magnets for surfers. So are you seeing people actually come to the areas to swim?
I have not noticed that. I'm just looking at, one very small part of the ocean right now. I don't see anybody in the water. So that's a good sign. Nobody should be in there right now. But I think the strength of the storm and the intensity of it is at least giving people pause.
Erin James of the Virginia Pilot speaking to us from the Outer Banks of North Carolina, keeping an eye on Hurricane Earl as it bears down. Erin, thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, hotels and college campuses buzzing over bed bugs, how not to let the bed bugs bite, in 30 seconds, here and now. Well, it's back to college week, and here in Boston, that means streets lined with discarded furniture from previous occupants, there for the taking. But this year, there's a twist. Stickers from city officials that read, "Caution, this item may contain bed bugs." Boston is only number 11 on a list of the most bed bug infested cities in the U.S. It's put together by Terminix, the pest control company. New York, Philadelphia, and Detroit top the list. But officials here worry that bed bugs are being transported. And how bad can that be? Well, in New York, people who've had bed bugs say they're treated like lepers. People won't let them come over. After an infestation in a DA's office, lawyers decided to meet clients at a Starbucks. And there are dogs trained to smell and ferret out bed bugs. Let's find out more with Gary Alpert. He's a bed bug expert at Harvard University's Department of Environmental Health and Safety. And Gary, first of all, to cynics who say this is just the pest control companies ginning this up, you say it is a real problem. You tell us bed bugs do bite, but they can't fly or hop and they don't carry disease, correct?
Yes, and it's a common misconception that every little flat insect in your home is a bed bug. The bed bug itself, think of a flattened apple seed for an adult bed bug. And they move at a pace. They can actually crawl. Think of it as an inch every maybe 10 seconds. Hmm. So they can move. And the smaller bed bugs, which you might call the nymphal or baby bed bugs, are much, much smaller but still visible to the naked eye.
I'm itching, by the way, as we're speaking,
right. Yes.
because they sort of can also grow exponentially. I mean, the number can grow. So let's talk about that. Why has there been a surge?
The best data we have in North America is that there were no bed bugs anywhere in New England, for example, before 2006.
Hmm.
But starting in 2006, it's almost doubled every year. And this year probably will be a banner year again. So the curve hasn't flattened out yet on the increase. And we think it's because the general public is unaware of actions that they're taking that actually spreads bed bug accidentally.
Well, let's talk about those because I'm looking at some statistics from New York. The city's 311 helpline there had over 12,000 bed bug complaints, mm-hmm. 16% more than the year before, 39% above the year before that. And yes, you say there are some things people are doing, but maybe things we're also not doing, we're not using as much pesticides?
I don't think that's as complete an answer as I'd like to give. We still have a lot of pesticides that we use indoors, and those pesticides are still very effective at controlling bed bugs. If you want to spread bed bugs, First thing, travel a lot. Bring your suitcase with you. Go to a lot of different motels. Leave your suitcase by the bed. Let the bed bugs crawl in. And then return with the suitcase, open it up, realize you've brought them, and then instead of controlling it right away, move out and leave your unit for a few days and let them spread to all the adjacent areas.
Oh, boy. Well, now, you also say something as simple as keeping your luggage as far away from the bed in a hotel as you possibly can.
Correct. And when you return from a trip, just don't bring your suitcase directly into the house. You might want to take some of the belongings and put it in a dryer, 140 degrees for about 20 minutes. That'll kill all stages of bed bugs.
Don't take your favorite pillow with you because that can also transfer bed bugs. But is there some way you can, when you get to a hotel, look and see if the hotel has bed bugs?
The first thing to do is strip the sheets. Take them right off the mattress, at the headboard especially, and look along the seams along the headside. And if there are bed bugs there, you'll see not only the bugs moving, but you'll also see little spots of blood where it's been feeding and defecating. So those are signs that will stain the sheets. So if you see what looks like little drops of blood or anything moving, check out before you check in.
Well, you know, I think in general, if I see blood bed in a hotel room, it's probably a good idea to move on. But we take what you're saying.
You have to pull the sheets out and actually look at the mattress under.
Well, tell us some other things about the nature of bed bugs that make this a problem. For instance, how long can they lie dormant?
You'll read and hear that bed bugs can last as long as a year between a blood meal, so that sounds like an almost impossible task. But that's probably a laboratory setting, so probably a six-month period would be a more normal period between blood meals.
Well, so let's get to what can you do. If you've had bed bugs, I mean, obviously there are some people who can throw away mattresses. Not everybody can. So can you encase the mattress in some way and kill the bed bugs?
Yes, it's much better. If you throw the mattress away and buy a new one, the bed bugs like new mattresses as well as old. So there's a chance that it'll just get reinfested.
Sure.
But there are great encasements, bed bug tight mattress covers. So you don't have to throw things out.
But then how do you keep new bed bugs from, you know, marching one by one up your bed frame leg? We've heard about putting the legs of your bed frame in dishes of mineral oil. We've heard about rubbing, I think, a petroleum jelly substance or something.
Sure, Vaseline will work. But a sticky trap sometimes is a little bit simpler. And you can buy these at a lot of stores. Put those under the four legs of your bed so you can isolate the legs of the bed. So now you've protected the mattress and the bed, but you still have the bed frame. And that's where a lot of the bed bugs are.
In the wood and stuff.
In the wood of the frame. That's where a professional is usually advised to bring in to treat that bed frame.
We've also heard that you can take your bed and put it out in the heat, but also put it out in the freezing cold. Which is true? Which will kill the bed bugs?
I think both of them are a little bit ill-advised because the bed bugs insert themselves in these cracks and the little pocket of air in there is somewhat insulated. If you're up in the Arctic or you're out in the desert, you might try one or the other, but not here in New England.
Are we making too much out of this? I can hear people who've not had this problem thinking, are you kidding me? You know, how bad could it be? How bad does it get?
One could predict that almost everybody listening to this will know somebody, either personally or a relative or a friend of a friend, that will probably experience bed bugs over the next 3 or 4 years.
But again, can you take it too far? I mean, we hear reports of people in New York City who won't go to the movies anymore, who won't sit on wooden benches because of a fear. Is it based in reality?
The rule of thumb that people should use is that since bed bugs do feed at night, something like an office building where you work is not a proper place for bed bugs to survive.
It's not likely that they're clinging to the bottom of your shoe.
Absolutely. Or clinging to your clothes or clinging to your body.
Yeah.
Because remember, after feeding, they drop off.
They leave an itchy bite, but what else do they do?
It's psychological. You lose sleep, you lose friends, you lose your composure, and you spend a lot of time worrying. So I think those are significant downsides to bed bugs, putting aside that there's no disease.
Well, in fact, the reason I mention it, there are psychotherapists in New York who are treating bed bug victims.
Well, there's also a small subset with delusionary parasitosis who imagine that they're being bitten by something.
Who knew? Gary Albert, bed bug expert. He's written an informative pamphlet on how to spot and get rid of the bugs, and it comes with lots of really gross close-up pictures of bedbugs.
Yes.
So we'll let you know how to get that at our website, hereandnow.org. Gary, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, back with new old jazz here and now. Welcome back. It's been a great year for jazz fans. Invaluable recordings from the past, including live sets from the Newport Festival and after-hours New York loft recordings from Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk, have surfaced. But now comes what many consider to be the Holy Grail, the fabled Savory Collection. In the 1930s and 40s, sound engineer William Savory recorded hundreds of radio broadcasts featuring greats like Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong. But he only released a tiny selection of them. The rest remained unheard until Lauren Schoenberg, director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, got his hands on the collection. The BBC's Andrew Purcell reports on this treasure trove from the era of big band and swing.
It was widely assumed to be almost exclusively Benny Goodman material. The big surprise was when I finally found it this spring after 30 years of looking for it, that not only did it contain Benny Goodman, but it was really a treasure trove of pretty much all the major jazz artists of the time. You figure, you know, if somebody had this kind of collection of going on to 1,000 discs, that he would have told people, you know, my gosh, I've got Basie, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, John Kirby, Jack Teagarden, but he never did.
Grab your coat. Grab your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just a record feed on Sunnyside Street.
Schoenberg first asked Savory about the collection in 1980 while working for Benny Goodman as an archivist.
Three or four times a year I would call him or write him letters and just say, hey, Bill, what's up? You know, can I come visit? Can I listen to it? Can I see a list? And he just put me off. He didn't want to, he just didn't share it, and I wouldn't stop. And so he died in 2004, and I eventually reached his son early this year. He looked in his father's collection, and he saw all these letters from me, so he knew I was bona fide. And then, yeah, we rented a van, drove it across overnight, and put it in storage, praying the whole time that nothing untoward happened with the van and the discs, and we made it.
Once he arrived in New York, he entrusted the collection to veteran sound engineer Doug Pomeroy, himself a massive jazz fan. At the age of 73, after a career rescuing and restoring classic records, he was looking forward to retirement.
Well, I wasn't really retired. I've never stopped working because I love this work. But I didn't really want to take on a job like this until he came here and we played one of the records, Count Basie with a Lester Young solo I had never heard before. Nobody's heard it since 1938. And I mean, I almost broke into tears. I was so moved.
Savory was an accomplished sound technician and a dedicated jazz fan who himself played piano and saxophone. In the late 1930s, his job was to record live radio broadcasts. It was a perfect fit for his passion and expertise.
He worked in a transcription studio that had state-of-the-art equipment, and some of these things were probably off the live feed. The majority that I've found so far are copies, but the copies are very good. So thank God he did, because he took them home and we don't know what happened to the rest of them.
The van that Lauren Schoenberg drove back to New York contained almost 1,000 discs. After 60 years boxed up in damp conditions, some were seriously damaged, but most are salvageable. I went to Doug Pomeroy's studio to hear how he does it.
This is cleaned with mineral spirits, and which completely removes this palmitic acid. And once they're cleaned, they sound very, very good. They sound better than the recordings made today of big bands. I think that the broadcast engineers from those years learned how to record a big band, and today it is a lost art. I'm going to play it whether you like it or not. Now listen to Harry James. My God, what a great jazz trumpeter. Basically, the project is to get everything transferred, first of all, which may take God only knows how long. But once all of this is done, Lauren will say, there are certain recordings we really want to clean them up.
Roughly speaking, to turn this to this. Almost all of the recorded music from the era was issued on shellac discs to be played at 78 revolutions per minute. This meant drastically cutting performances to fit at under 3 minutes long. Savory's collection enables us to hear the music as it was played in clubs, full of wild improvisation and complex interplay. The sessions hosted by WNEW presenter Martin Block are a prime example. Lawrence Schoenberg.
He would bring up the very best jazz players of his time, and they would play live in the studio. One session with Benny Goodman, Lester Young, and Roy Eldridge, and Teddy Wilson. Another one with Charlie Shavers and Lionel Hampton and Herschel Evans. Virtually all of the Martin Block jam sessions were just one-time, ad hoc jam sessions. And one of the amazing things is how cohesive the music is. It sounds like they were playing written arrangements. I mean, they just start playing. You know, these guys had never played together. They didn't rehearse. And they just had this intrinsic ability to cohere. And it's almost beyond belief.
So far, only 140 of the discs have been cleaned up and copied to CD. But in that first batch alone, there are versions of jazz standards that seem destined to become definitive. Coleman Hawkins stretching out over 6 minutes of Body and Soul. Billie Holiday with a slow, mournful reading of Strange Fruit.
Very strange.
It's spine-tingling to me to hear something that interesting.
Blood on the leaves.
You know, the fact that he never recorded that, and it only was broadcast that once, and nobody else has that recording. Nobody has heard it.
We've kind of made up our mind as music fans or historians or music lovers about all these artists and how they played and what they did. And there's so much material here that adds so much to the understanding that it really almost calls for a reassessment.
And so, friends, we come to the end of another Wednesday night jam session at your make-believe ballroom. Look forward to another one next Wednesday night at the same time. This is the American Broadcasting Company.
The late Bunny Berrigan on trumpet, ending that report from the BBC's Andrew Purcell in New York. And staying with music, a heads up, Monday on Here and Now, we'll visit with the great songwriter Jimmy Webb, singing his own songs with friends like Billy Joel. Here they are on Wichita Lineman.
And I need you more than I want you. And I want you for all time. And the Wichita Lineman is still on the line.
I saw the guy up on top of a telephone pole out in the panhandle of Oklahoma, and it was the image rather than, it wasn't the lyrics of the song or anything, it was like a cinematic clip. It was a piece of film that just went into my memory bank.